Welcome to Sate.
Okay.
A podcast about the foods that have shaped Malaysia. I'm Dr. Nobby Leong, scientist, food writer, and broadcaster.
And I'm Philip Gibson, photographer and regrettably British.
And in this series, we explore the history, cultures, and cuisines of Malaysia, from the ancient lands of Southeast Asia all the way through to the creation of a modern-day nation. In today's episode, we take a look at laksa and the great British lie. So, take your truth serum now and get ready for Sate.
Okay.
I've clearly been watching a lot of Bake Off and Traitors at the same time.
I'm both staples of British reality TV, I guess.
So in the last episode, we looked at the alliance between the Sultanate of Johor and the Dutch VOC, and they worked together to oust Portugal from Malacca. We also looked at the assassination of the Sultan of Johor in the late 17th century, 1699 to be precise.
Okay.
And that left a giant power vacuum in the region. So today we're going to continue that journey. We're going to look at what happened in the 18th century and who filled that void. But before we do that, let's take a look at our food of the day, the symbol that connects us to the past, and that is laksa. I love laksa.
Yeah, no, I do too. It's funny, the food that came out of the tropics does so well in the UK.
It's so well suited to cold weather.
Yeah, just thick, kind of creamy broth, well, spicy, coconut milk base, isn't it?
It doesn't have to be. So laksa is like a category of food, which is like a noodle soup where you've got noodles in a spicy broth.
Right. Yeah,
it often is creamy though.
When would I have had my first laksa? It's probably an Adelaide institution, Asian Gourmet.
Yes, by my uncle and auntie own Asian Gourmet. It is, that's my favourite laksa.
It's an institution as well, because it was probably one of the first Malaysian restaurants to open in Adelaide, in the 90s or something like that?
I think even earlier, in the late 80s is when Asian Gourmet first opened, and my uncle and auntie took it over in the early 90s.
Right, okay, wow, there you go. An institution of the Adelaide Central Markets, for those of you that are listening to us from the Antipodes.
I do think it's sort of the most famous Malaysian dish outside of Malaysia, particularly in Australia.
Definitely Australia. I would definitely say that most Brits are ignorant of all Malaysian food. And Sate, our podcast namesake, is too universal across Southeast Asia as a region, I think, for Malaysia to claim it.
Yeah.
There I said it. And so, laksa definitely in Australia, I think, is one of those things. I mean, Darwin in the Northern Territory has a laksa festival.
Yeah, laksa festival in Darwin. I've never been, but I would love to go. Apparently, you know, laksa is incredible over there.
Mm.
London, though, has a laksa restaurant, Sambal Siok by Mandy Yin.
Sells
a range of different laksas, so... Mm. I don't know why more Brits don't get behind laksa. Because Brits love curry.
Right.
And in winter, you kind of want something soupy, which Brits also love.
Yep.
So combine them both and you have laksa.
You're right. I mean, I think give Britain a chance. It's working its way through Thai food in kind of a big way.
Uh-huh.
It's only a matter of time before people come down the peninsula and get into the Malaysian offerings.
Yes. Hurry up, because I need more Malaysian offerings, please, Britain. okay, so there are quite a few different types of laksa. The most popular one is probably what you call maybe curry laksa or laksa lemak. So this is when the broth has got a lot of coconut milk in it, and there's also a lot of like seafood in it.
And you'll see like a healthy film of chili oil over the top
of it, right? Yeah, that's kind of what you want. We like to have our coconut milk split whenever it's in a sauce, so that you do get a film of red, fiery, spicy chili on top. The other really popular one is Penang laksa, also called Asam laksa. So that's a really sour tamarind-based laksa.
Mm-hmm.
Sarawak laksa, which sounds like a tongue twister for me. Sarawak laksa from Borneo, very prawn-heavy. You have a Nyonya laksa, very exuberant. Quail eggs, if you can get the really traditional one. You also have Johor laksa, which is probably, for me, the most fascinating one because it's made out of spaghettis. Spaghettis? It's made with spaghetti noodles rather than your typical yellow Hokkien noodles. And it originated from the Sultan of Johor, who visited Italy and then went back and asked his chefs to make laksa with Italian spaghetti. And it's also got things like salted turnips and just things you wouldn't really expect from the other laksas.
Yeah, as I work my way around Malaysia and I try all of the local laksas, I think I'm glad to say that I can say that I've tried it, but I am definitely more in a curry laksa kind of or nyonya laksa That's what I like.
Do you think that's just because that's your staple laksa, your default laksa?
Well, maybe, but also there was a Malaysian restaurant in Glasgow called Soundbite, which was up at the university, and they used to do a Singaporean laksa, which was an everything but the kitchen sink laksa. It had fried wontons in it and all kinds of stuff.
I kind of loved that.
It was great, though. It was in the way that Italian food's been bastardized in so many different ways. Here was Malaysians bastardizing their own food for a local market.
I have had a kitchen sink laksa in Adelaide once where it was like your regular laksa lemak with dumplings with also beef brisket. And it was incredible because it was like everything on the menu in one bowl.
Which is quite funny to me because as we learned over the course of this episode, the laksa typically should be made with only really seafood and maybe egg. And so it shouldn't actually have kind of meat or protein in it. Meat or poultry in it.
Yeah, that's what Malaysians would prefer is seafood. Mm-hmm. When I was growing up, my mum would kind of make it with chicken though.
Right.
And I think just because there were six of us in the family, chicken was much cheaper and just easier to portion out.
Yeah.
But typically, it'd be seafood. Okay, so that is laksa. So as we've talked about previously, Chinese Peranakan is like a hybrid culture of Chinese and Malay. And so laksa is a combination of the noodle traditions of China with the spice and curry traditions of the Malay world. Mm-hmm. So therefore you get this noodles in a spicy broth. So there's been a Chinese community on the Malay Peninsula for as long as there has been trade, so centuries. Mm-hmm. And so you've probably got some form of Chinese Peranakan tradition coming into play for hundreds of years as well. But Chinese people came to the Malay Peninsula in much greater numbers during the time of Britain's occupation of the peninsula.
How did we get there?
Okay, well that leads us to our history lesson of the day. So last episode, we talked about the rulers of Johor and Dutch VOC working together to oust Portugal.
Right.
The Dutch VOC wanted a monopoly on the spice trade, and they went through with their ethnic cleansing of the people of Banda Islands, the Spice Islands, so that the Dutch could acquire and monopolize nutmeg.
After we recorded last episode, I was thinking about Michael Caine's quote from one of the Austin Power films, which is, there's only two people I hate in this world, people who are intolerant of other people's cultures and the Dutch.
One and the same, really, in this case.
Yeah, I had an English teacher that used to say something incredulously, if that happens, then you can call me Dutch. It was always like Dutch was the butt of the joke. Yeah.
I wonder if that this is where that came from.
Well, not Michael Caine.
Michael Caine.
The British hatred of the Dutch.
And their reputation in the 16th, 17th century as being at war with everyone.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of like British sayings that are kind of nautical based. Like when something's on the floor, we would say it's on the deck. Or not to make my nana sound like an alcoholic, but if it was that time, if somebody was saying, oh, should we go for a drink? And my nana would always say, well, the sun's over the yardarm. And I had to look up what the fuck a yardarm was. And apparently it's a part of the rigging on a boat, which means the sun was over the yardarm at about 11 a.m.
Uh-huh. Well, she wasn't in. She wasn't a seafarer.
She wasn't very much land-based. But but I think what I mean though is I think if British English speakers think about how many kind of sayings and idioms we have, colloquialisms that are actually probably rooted in maritime something.
Yeah, I think we need to do another podcast, but about the etymology of all these different phrases and sayings.
Maybe there's a idiom okay podcast.
Idiom? Okay.
Anyway.
Okay, so with Portugal out of the equation, the Malay rulers of Johor enjoyed prosperity for a little while, but then the Sultan of Johor, Sultan Mahmud Shah II, was assassinated. He didn't have any heirs.
He was young.
But he came from a long line of rulers that traced their lineage from Johor to Malacca to Srivijaya all the way back to Alexander the Great.
Sorry, I shouldn't laugh. Anyway.
I think the laughter's not coming from humour. It's like the incredulity of it all.
It's the disbelief of the fact that here we have one of the most famous kind of warriors or military leaders of history that somehow spread his seed into Southeast Asia. But yeah, who knows what they were trading on those boats. But yeah, anyway.
So this left a huge power vacuum in the region, and that's where we are today, Malaysia, into the 18th century. So without this centralized power, we have all these different people trying to vie for trade, for royal prestige. And Philip, I'm just going to run you through a list of all the different people that are trying to like claim some power for themselves.
Okay, I'm ready.
Okay, so first of all, it's the nobles of Johor. Right. So without a sultan there, all these noblemen claiming that, oh, they're next in line to the throne because their daughter married something, all that kind of stuff.
Okay.
You then have a rise in other royal courts around the Malay Peninsula. So places like Kedah, Selangor, and Terengganu. So those names might not sound familiar to you, but if you looked at a map of Malaysia today, you would see that these are the states of Malaysia. So some of the states of Malaysia that we have today have their origins with the regicide of a sultan, which is fascinating. You then have an increase in people from across the archipelago, the Bugis from Sulawesi, Minangkabau from Sumatra, and they are kind of jostling with Malay people, setting up their own courts.
Mm-hmm.
The Dutch are getting more involved. So previously, Dutch didn't care about local politics, but now they are kind of getting into the nitty-gritty of these royal power plays. And you also have a lot of pirates now. Without sort of an authority, you just have a lot of...
Yeah, everybody's vying for themselves, I think, and kind of working in their own self-interest, which, you know, I guess that... has almost been the theme of what keeps happening here is that we get 100 years into something and then somebody dies and there's a massive power shift.
It's really interesting though, a lot of these like pirates are actually royalty themselves. So this was at a time when polygamy was quite common in the royal courts.
Okay.
And so you had a lot of like princes existing that couldn't get absorbed into the royal court. So they would just leave and become pirates.
Yeah.
So with all these different people, so much tension, you've got lots of civil unrest, a lot of like battles and wars, squabbling families, alliances. And so rather than power being centralized and consolidated as it had previously been, it was really quite spread out. And this was happening at a time when trade in the Malay Peninsula was really booming as well. And one particular beverage sparked this trade boom.
What could that be?
Tea!
Of course.
Britain's favourite beverage. So in the beginning of the 18th century, tea was really popular across Europe. Demand was super high.
I believe at one point it was importing something like 13.5 million kilos of it.
Oh my, geez, that is a lot of tea.
Yeah, it was something almost about half a kilo per person per year.
Wow.
Was the tea consumption.
Now, when you put it that way, it's actually like, oh, that's a normal amount of tea. Well, these days, you know.
Yeah, I'm trying to think how much is in a box of tea that I'm buying, but yeah, anyway.
Yeah. So tea obviously comes from China, and so Europe had to directly trade with China in order to get the goods. But the thing is, China didn't actually want products that Europeans were offering. Aside from silver, they didn't want the textiles that Europe was producing that they had a lot of. So Europeans needed to find an intermediary product, something else that Chinese traders wanted. And historically, they were things like metal, agricultural products, spices, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how the Malay Peninsula started to attract trade from Britain. So enter the British East India Company. They are a trading company. And like the Dutch VOC, they're kind of like an arm of the British Crown. And they're well placed to kind of get the resources from the Malay Peninsula and then sell that onto China. Few reasons why that might be. And surprise, surprise, it's got everything to do with colonialism.
Mm-hmm.
The British East India Company by the 1700s had gained a pretty tight control over lots of parts of India, including the cloth producing regions and the poppy producing regions.
Right.
Poppy being where we get opium from.
Mm.
So the British East India Company could trade cloth and opium products to the Malay Peninsula to get products like pepper and tin.
Right.
And Malay pepper and tin were highly valued in China. So in summary, products from India got them products from the Malay Peninsula, which got them tea from China. And so Britain starts to become a really big trading player in the region, but it quickly becomes clear that they need more.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it doesn't become clear. They just want more because they're insatiable. They want more tea. They want more money. They want to exploit as much as they can.
Yeah.
And so just like the Dutch before them, they're trying to control the trade routes. They're trying to control the production. And an opportunity arises for the British East India Company in the late 18th century with an unlikely event, a new dynasty in Bangkok, Thailand.
Okay.
So I'm just going to sidestep here. Because it all connects, Philip, I promise.
Right, right, yeah.
In 1782, we have a new dynasty in Bangkok, and the northern states of Malaysia, the Malay Peninsula, are pretty uneasy about this new dynasty because they don't know what tributes this new king is going to demand, whether that be lots of gold, lots of men, or lots of weapons. Mm-hmm. So the Sultan of Kedah, and so Kedah being the northern royal court of the Malay Peninsula, starts the chat with the British East India Company. The Sultan is like, all right, if you help us, if you protect us in a possible attack from Siam, Thailand, mm-hmm. we will give you the island of Penang as a lease. And so they come to an agreement. And in August 1786, Francis Light of the British East India Company takes possession of Penang. Side note here for my friends in Adelaide. Mm-hmm. Francis Light is the father of Colonel William Light, who would go on to become the founder of the city of Adelaide.
Oh, he was the surveyor, right?
Yeah, he was the surveyor general who laid out plans for the city of Adelaide.
The more you know.
So yeah, colonizing runs in the family. Well, kind of the worst form of nepotism.
Maybe.
And so the time came. The new Thai overlords do demand an extreme amount of tributes from the Malay rulers, and the Malay rulers resist. They call upon the British to help them, but Britain does not respond. The reason why is that Francis Light probably didn't have permission from the British crown to sign this treaty with the Sultan of Kedah. So Britain does not want to help them in this war.
Right.
They want to honor the deal though, so they send 12 men. In exchange for the island of Penang, Britain provided 12 measly soldiers. Therefore, they can claim that they held up their side of the bargain and have legally acquired Penang.
And this is in 1786.
Yes. And that is the Great British Lie.
Yeah, it was definitely a bit of embellishing on the offer there. A poorly worded contract, maybe.
And this becomes a theme across the history of Britain's colonial legacy. Like, this is just one of many lies that Britain told at the time in order to achieve more power, achieve more land, things like that. If you're enjoying this episode, you can follow us on social media at SateOK. We'll be sharing beautiful photos taken by Philip of Malaysia, its people, and of course, the food. We'll also share photos of Malaysia from the archives, so you can see how the country has changed over time. You can also find links to give us a tip or donation to show your appreciation for the work we're doing. So head to our socials at SateOK or visit our website, sateok.com. So Britain now gains a foothold in the region and they start to operate Penang, just like all the other trading ports around the region, like Malacca previously.
I heard a funny anecdote about when Francis Light got over to Penang and the island was completely covered in dense forest, as most of the area is, but this the trees that were growing along the kind of bay where Georgetown was now settled, I believe, were made of such dense wood that the axes that they brought with them from India were made of such steel that they had to go down and trade with metal workers in Malacca to go and get better steel. But so hard was it that in the 3 weeks that they were away going down to Malacca to get these axes, Colonel Light, in a deeply unserious move, filled his cannons with money.
Like coins.
Coinage, Yeah. And shot it into the undergrowth along the river, the waterfront, to encourage the men to go off and do a bit of a treasure hunt, and in the process, get rid of all of the scrub that grew at the base of these trees, so that when they finally had all of their axes and tools or whatever, they could get rid of the rest of it. So
wow.
Something that sounds like a Boy Scout exercise.
I don't, if this was in a fictional TV show, I would think that is stupid and ridiculous.
Yeah, you would make it up, wouldn't you?
But yeah.
So the more that I start to read about these kind of colonial books about what people were getting up to, particularly the British, they had so much power that they seemed to acquire it very unseriously.
Yeah.
Everything was just a bit of a kind of like,
a bit
of a kind of wheeler dealer, a bit of a Del Boy, kind of like only fools and horses. Yeah. But I like the idea of him parking his boat outside Georgetown and just firing coinage into and getting people to chase after pennies with small knives to cut through grasses and vines and whatever else.
That's one way to pay for gardening work.
Well, yeah.
So now Britain has a foothold in the Straits of Malacca, that super vital region that's connecting trade between India and China. And with that, there's now this massive boom in tin mining, there's a massive boom in agriculture, and with that, a massive increase in labor. And so what we start to now see is people filling this labor force gap. We have a lot of Indians coming from the Coromandel Coast.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of Arabs from Hadramaut, which is in the southern part of the Arabian Peninsula.
Okay.
And we have a lot of Chinese people, particularly from southern China.
Right.
And so these three migrant groups join an existing community that's been in the Malay Peninsula for hundreds of years, but now in much, much larger numbers. And so this influx of people gives rise to new cultures called Peranakan. So previously we have talked about Peranakan cultures with the Malacca Chetties and also the Eurasian community, the Kristang community.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to dive deeper today to learn a bit more about these diverse Peranakan communities. And so to do this, we spoke to Dr. David Neo. So David Neo is a researcher in Peranakan culture, and we spoke to him at his home in Kuala Lumpur.
Okay, I'm David Neo. Do you want me to go on about my family background?
Yeah, you can.
Okay, so I guess I'm Peranakan on both sides of the family. So my dad's family we probably can trace as far back as about 10 generations in Malacca. And mom is from, well, mom's family is more established in Singapore, so I think there's probably about like 5 generations of Peranakans in Singapore. So I was born and bred in Singapore, and then went abroad for my tertiary education. And I guess I found my way back to Asia about 10 years ago. I am a Chinese Peranakan, so of course it's like, you know, I know that best. But the thing is that since being here, there are like at least sort of 9 Peranakan communities that are documented in Malaysia. Yeah, so of course, Yo Baba Nonya is the most known Peranakan group, but you also have the Indian Peranakans, which are the Malacca Chetties. You have your Jawi Peranakans, which are the Arabs intermarrying with the locals. It's like, then in the East Coast, you have Kelantan and Terengganu that have very strong Thai influence, in their Peranakan culture. So there's actually really a variety in Malaysia, and I have sort of like basically kind of just been looking more at Malacca in the last 10 years. It's like, you know, so I really want to kind of like do more work with the East Coast and particularly also Indonesia, because I think, you know, there are a lot more pockets of Peranakan cultures in Indonesia.
While Peranakan cultures are typically associated with Malaysia and Singapore, the phenomenon may also extend to other countries across Southeast Asia.
Okay, so the term Peranakan is a Malay term, right, which means locally born. And it has basically come to describe your mixed race groups that have basically kind of like that were born in the Malay archipelago. So that is what Peranakan means. And if you go into all the many different parts of Southeast Asia, you'll find this phenomenon. But the thing is that regional differences would be there. Yeah. So that's where the term comes from. So the term pretty much has been developed or like made popular by Singapore and sort of like them being in the forefront of Peranakan or all things Peranakan, basically. But the thing is that there are other groups that are similar. Yeah. Mm. So you have like the Sanglis in the Philippines, so the Chinese merchants who've sort of like acculturated and assimilated, and they were wealthy as well because they were merchants, so they were very similar to the Peranakans. In fact, someone, a Filipino friend of mine, actually explained the word sangli to me. It's like, he says that it's actually from your Hokkien word sangli, which is business. Yeah, it's like, you know, yeah. So this is, so it actually is very much like the Peranakan culture as well. But would you classify them as Peranakans? It's like, you know, you have Phuket that, you know, also has a very big community of Peranakans who were basically the Penang Peranakans that established second homes in Phuket and also took advantage of the tin mining and whatnot there. Rangoon is another place. It's like, you know, so the whole Peranakan word does get problematic in terms of, you know, the categorization and how do you define Peranakan.
So I think it's super important to clarify that when we say Peranakan, it's quite a big category of lots of different cultures.
Right.
And I say that because I think in Australia and UK and lots of other places, a lot of people, if they come across the word Peranakan, it's only in reference to Chinese Peranakans.
Right.
And they assume that there's no other type of Peranakan. Mm-hmm. And as David was saying, which was something I learned for the first time, there were also quote-unquote Peranakans in Thailand, in Philippines, and all over Southeast Asia, which I thought was, obvious, but fascinating.
Right, and I think you were having a bit of identity crisis when you were over there. It's kind of like, am I Peranakan?
Well, so my grandmother is Chinese Peranakan. She's Nyonya.
Right.
So I do have that heritage, but yeah, I'm constantly trying to think of where does Chinese Peranakan fit into my life?
Beyond the plate.
Beyond the plate. And it kind of adds to the complex identity issues that I have of whether I'm Malaysian, Chinese Malaysian, Australian, da-da-da-da-da.
Yeah.
So perhaps the reason why Chinese Peranakans are the most spoken about outside of Malaysia is because they're probably the largest group. So you might hear them talked about as Baba Nyonya, and Baba is the name for the men, and Nyonya is the term for the women. So you will sometimes hear Chinese Peranakan culture being talked about as Baba Nyonya culture. So to find out more about Chinese Peranakans, we spoke to Lillian Tong from Penang, and I'll let her introduce herself.
So my name is Lillian Tong, and I am the Museum Director of Penang Peranakan Mansion, and also the President of the Persatuan Peranakan Baba Nyonya Pulau Pinang, Deputy President of the State Chinese Association, which formerly was a British Straits Chinese Association, and Council Member of the Penang Heritage Trust.
Lillian Tong grew up in Penang, though she wasn't initially aware of her own heritage.
So as a child, life was happy. I thought everybody was Baba Nyonya until I went to school and realised that people speak Chinese in a different way from my Baba Hokkien. And then when I was older in secondary school, when I visited my friends in the house, then I realized they dress differently. My grandmother is always in tesa and sarong, so their grandmothers is different. And then, of course, you know, you understand that people are different, so you accept that. And of course, when I was younger, it didn't mean anything. You are just who you are. When I was in my 20s, 30s, it was career and looking after my family, so I never thought about who I am or the culture. But when my children, my children grew up, and then that's when I got interested. One turning point in my life was when I was having to go for a surgery, and I thought I'm going to die. And I was so worried about whether my daughter will know who she is, Chinese or Nyonya. And that who she is will form her worldview of how she lived out her life.
Lillian explained to me some of the ways that she learnt about her own culture. One moment was during her career in film and television, where she worked alongside older Nyonya women.
When I was filming The King and I was a street woman in a market selling or buying vegetables and all that. And so we were dressed like, you know, casually, and we are supposed to behave likewise. So during break time, when we had buns and we are tired, we'll just sit by the longkang, the drain, and just eat the buns. But when I was filming Road to Dawn, acting as a Nyonya, and in Little Nyonya, or even Sensei Nyonya, the call time was 5 o'clock for makeup. And that means 5 o'clock in the morning till 7 o'clock at night. We had no chairs. They didn't give us any chairs. so, you know, as we're so tired throughout the day, we wanted to lean on the tree or even to squat. And the older nonyas will say, hey, please, that's rono. You know, it's not proper. It's improper for, you know, nonyas to be, you know, leaning on the tree. You just have to carry yourself. So then, even when there was a lunchtime, and the older nonyas will say, no, we let them go and eat first. If there's leftover, then we'll take whatever. We won't rush for it. So then I realized how, when I think I'm a street girl in a market, I behave likewise. Mm. And then when I am a nonya, I hold myself differently. Mm. So that is the whole view of how then you live out your life. Yeah.
So there's a huge array of cultural traditions, from the etiquette to the clothing and the food. Lillian explained just some of the aspects of Chinese Peranakan culture and the reasons why we often shorten this to Nyonya culture and cuisine.
There was one symposium that I went to that says the people who carries the culture or preserves or conserve the culture are the women. Well, I cannot say that the men did nothing because they actually went out to work. They gave us the money to do everything. And so the culture was brewed and grew within the home, each home. So the nonya having the money and the time and the many servants or her friends and the many children she has, then starts to cook and does all this. So visibly even, if you see nonya cooking, it's the ladies. Of course, today they're men. If you see kabaya, it's a woman. Our kasomane is a woman. Our ronggeng? Oh, no. Ronggeng is mixed. So, donang sayang is men. So you'll see that a lot of it is carried by the women.
Food is, of course, a huge part of Chinese Peranakan culture. And Lillian shared why it's so important.
I think it is, as in most culture, very important because it is where you bring people together and families together. And friendships are made, which is why when you have a business a discussion or meeting, sometimes people will say meet over dinner. Mm. I think that food changes a lot of things. So it is with Baba Nyonya families too, that which is why like Chinese New Year, birthdays, especially reunions, or like the Soyi Festival, the Tongyin Festival, families need to come together, must come together in the past. But now, today, with children like in Sarawak and KL, it's difficult. But in those days, people come together. And in fact, not only coming together to eat, coming together to prepare food. And I think that is such a bonding time.
And it's a cuisine that's truly hybrid, not just between Chinese and Malay, but with influences reflective of its colonial origins.
I think it's the most amazing. I mean, and I'm not being biased just because I'm Nonya. Because if you go to our kitchen, which later I'll show you, there's a Dutch coal scuttle, and there are Malay moles, Indian blanka, the pots, and Chinese koi ka pek ting and all that. Everything from all over the world is in one kitchen. English jelly moles, the blanche or something, like white porcelain jelly moles, usually shaped like rabbits. Everything from all over the world. So can you imagine? That means we are cooking a mix of everything. Because Penang was a port city. That was a gilded age. And I think that gave the foundation to our cooking. Besides being in Penang, we are, Baba Nonyas are married to Thai, Burmese, Indonesians. So all these flavors from Nusantara and the Chinese background and your Indian curry. Chinese here don't eat curry, you know. I mean like the real Chinese. I have Chinese friends who never ate curry until they have met me. I think like roti canai, they never tried it. So that's what we are, like such a mix-up people. And happy about it. Yeah.
Despite how much she loves food, Lillian says she doesn't actually cook.
I actually don't have much interest in cooking because my mother was such a good cook. She was so meticulous that everything has to be chiffonade, very fine, And even the carrot that's going to be thrown into a soup to make stock, it has to be cut into flowers. Yeah, and then if you don't do that, she'll like, do it again, or not fine enough, then get scolding. Mm. So it's like, I'm never good enough. You know, that kind of feeling. So I don't even want to try now.
So we're going to hear a little bit more from Lillian David in just a tick. But I just thought it was really interesting to hear her describe the cuisine and the culture, because a lot of people would call it really refined, fine clothing, fine etiquette.
Yeah, you totally get an idea of the kind of how labour intensive that all is with when we think back to the interview with the Malacca Chettys and Amuda just kind of audibly sighing when she just talked about how much preparation went into all the chiffon adding as she talks about. But you know, that was their status, wasn't it? If they were to be serving this food that was to be this immaculate, then it gave off the sense of fineness and opulence.
Yeah, and you get a sense of the wealth involved with these Chinese Peranakan communities, and that wealth is reflected in its origins.
Right.
So David Neo elaborated more on the origins of Chinese Peranakan culture and how it's changed over time.
Peranakan culture, I think, is a product of colonialism. Mm. I think colonialism gave the opportunities to the Peranakans to basically flourish. I would say the biggest Peranakan group would be the Chinese Peranakans. Mm. It's like, yes. And so their golden age was really 1850s to 1920s. Mm. So that was when at that time too, it was like, you know, they were about 2-3 generations maybe. It's like, you know, here in Southeast Asia, and their drive to sort of like, you know, succeed or there's no more option of going back to China, I think sort of like, you know, drove them to amass the wealth that they amassed, right, at that time. With the British being here, it's like, you know, and how they developed the Strait settlement. It's like, you know, the Peranakans basically became rich from all the opportunities that came from that. So that was basically sort of, you know, their golden age.
The idea of Peranakan culture flourishing and also being a product of colonialism is a really interesting one. And David shared with me the impacts of this wealth and power on the community dynamics.
Nonyas are, to me, privilege. I've actually written a paper on the Nonya imaginary. It's like, you know, and this was my argument in the paper that that Nonyas were valued and privileged. It's like, you know, and they actually endorse or they perpetuate the patriarchy with your patrilineal line and patrilineal focus in the Peranakan culture of, you know, wanting a son and continuing the family name. So the oppression didn't come from men, but the oppression actually came from Nonyas. So my argument there was that Nonyas are actually very privileged, and they've always they occupy a very interesting space in Peranakan culture, because they are not oppressed like how most women are oppressed by patriarchy.
The privilege of Nonyas then filtered into other aspects of the culture, like cuisine.
So they grew up very privileged, and they grew up also sort of like, you know, in the kitchen and in this culture. And so the older generations basically had to learn to cook that was their value, right? That was how they would be able to get married. That was et cetera, et cetera. It's like, you know, their role was very much in the home.
The hallmarks of the cuisine that Lillian mentioned almost take on a new understanding against the arguments by David. And we start to see that Nyonya cuisine, which often includes fine chiffonading of ingredients, the use of European molds and equipment, the very specific demands on the taste and texture of the food, are all reflections of the status of privileged Chinese Peranakans in society. However, that was, in many ways, in the Golden Age. And David shared with me how changes in the 20th century signaled a decline and the end of that golden era.
So you have the Great Depression that came in. That was sort of like, you know, the first thing that started crippling their wealth. It's like, and then then the Second World War pretty much decimated a lot of the wealthy Peranakan's wealth.
Aside from their wealth being decimated, their entire identity was being attacked too. After Malaysian independence, there was an increase in the number of new migrants from China, and this became a source of tension between Chinese Peranakans and the new class of Chinese migrants.
With independence, I think particularly the 50s and the 60s, it's like the Peranakans were starting, that was sort of like the OCBC time. Okay, so OCBC basically, it's an acronym for a bank. Yeah, it's a popular bank here, and what they have done is they've actually used it to mean orang Cina bukan Cina. So you know, you're Chinese but you're not Chinese, to describe the Peranakans. So I think with sort of like the Peranakans diminishing prominence in the 50s and the 60s, they started feeling, or with the rise as well with the later Chinese immigrants, because there's always this tension, the Peranakans would look down at the later Chinese immigrants. And so with the later Chinese immigrants growing to be more prominent, there was a discrimination with the Peranakan. So I think that's where the term comes from. And I guess there was that time when people were ashamed of, you know, wearing kebayas and not wanting to wear kebayas or be associated with the Peranakan culture or to be associated or to be known as Chinese but not Chinese.
This discrimination led a lot of people to question their identity and feel ashamed.
Their prominence, I guess, had dropped, and also it's like, you know, it also affected that generation in terms of how they saw themselves as well. So, like with my cousin, it's like, you know, I know this term sort of like, you know, resonates with her more than it does with me, because I kind of like celebrate the fact that, you know, I am orang Cina, bukan Cina. It's like, you know, but to her, it's like, I think she's even sort of like learning Mandarin now to sort of make up or compensate for not being Chinese enough. I don't feel that need. It's like, you know, I am quite happy to be Cina Buta. It's like, you know, which is, if you translate that from Malay, it's like being Chinese blind. Yeah, it's like, so it's, I think we have very different experiences with the Peranakan culture.
Lillian echoed the sentiments of David, and she told me the story of her own family's struggle with discrimination.
At one point, like maybe say 1980s, 1990s, it was going down. And I have aunties in Malacca from very old families who tell me that they were so ashamed when they went to school because people would be laughing at them and say, orang Cina bukan Cina. And which is like, you are a mixed breed, you know, like they were looked down upon. And they would come home crying, and she said she hated school. She's probably 90 years old now.
But it wasn't just social issues that caused the decline. Administrative issues also played a role in downplaying Chinese Peranakan identity, especially when it comes to identity cards, or ICs, and other official government documents.
So a lot of us have become or identify ourselves as Chinese, because in the IC and everywhere else is Malay, Chinese, Indian. So you just take Chinese and others. So we don't normally bother with Baba Nonya. And so it became lost. Like even in my IC, it was Chinese, because there was just three to choose from. Even as in school, you just take the one that, you know, suits you best.
But things turned around in the 1980s and 1990s, when Chinese Peranakan culture saw a massive revival.
I attribute the revival to two events. One is our Prime Minister Badawi's wife, Andon, Datin Sri Andon. She wrote a book on kebaya, and she promoted it. She visited the Nonya, Baba Nonya Associations, and brought it to Australia, brought it to the National Museum, which I went and danced, and there was a big exhibition. So she started in Malaysia, and then Little Nonya, the movie. So Little Nonya did the movie, and they filmed here, which also made us famous. Otherwise, you know, where in my when I was here in the beginning, people will just come and say, is this where Little Nonya was filmed? So I knew that that was a selling point, you see. So because of this too, it created an interest. And now today, look at all the tourists here. Yeah. They are from China, and where did they hear that you must dress in a sarung kebaya? And they will pay to rent and take photos. And then Nonya restaurant, I think in the last, even before COVID, say, so last 8 years, start to mushroom up. Because that means there must be demand, and people are asking for it, and there is awareness. And don't ask me which one is the best Nonya restaurant. Because, you know, every restaurant, I find, have their own specialty. Like if you go Baba Pang, make sure you order their kerabu, like the best ever. And then another place, you go for the lobak. So there's not that one restaurant has it all.
So from a golden age in the 19th century, followed by a steep decline from the 1920s, and then a resurgence in the 1980s and 90s, Chinese Peranakan culture has undergone vast changes. But what does the future hold for the culture and community in the modern age?
I think our idea of identity is actually more self-conscious now than it has ever been. I think, you know, the last 500 years it's just evolved, and people sort of like just saw themselves as what they are. But it's like, you know, I think in this modern age, it's like we are becoming more self-conscious in terms of our cultural and self-identity as well.
Why do you think that's the case? Why is there this shift to
globalization? I don't know. I'm thinking a lot about Singapore context in terms of this, because maybe that's also tied to my own sort of like background or understanding. I find that Singapore tends to be very self-conscious in terms of these cultural identities, because I think they have modernized so fast, and so they've sort of like lost their culture, and they're basically searching for their culture. I think more so than Malaysia. It's like, you know, in my experience, and in what I think, it's like, you know, Malaysians tend to be more comfortable with themselves than Singapore. I think Singapore is always sort of like searching, and I think, you know, the fact that they've developed so fast is one of the reasons why there's this lack or this deep sense of nostalgia for Peranakan culture and whatever else.
Even though there is now an increased awareness and popularity of Chinese Peranakan culture, David shared with me some of the drawbacks.
Okay, this I have a lot of issues with that. It's like, because I think there's a lot of marketing ploy and commodification that's going on, and that's one of the issues that I have with sort of like, you know, your restaurants and the Peranakan culture that's now kind of like, you know, circulating. And I think, you know, most of it probably sort of like started with Singapore, with, you know, tourism board promoting it and whatnot. So now it becomes this, you know, commodified culture that I sometimes think is really not authentic anymore. It's like, you know, so one of my issues is blue rice. Like, you know, this whole blue rice thing. I have never seen blue rice growing up, you know, in a Peranakan home, in the Peranakan kitchen. It's like, you know, we never stain our rice blue. We stain our pulut, our glutinous rice blue. It's like, you know, and that's basically just for desserts. It's like, but we don't do blue rice. So now these days, you know, it's pretty, yes, it's like, you know, the restaurants are sort of like selling it, but I'm just going like, what's Peranakan about that? And when I walk in, when I walk into a Peranakan restaurant these days as well, I find that, you know, I don't recognize half the things that are in the menu. So I find that there's a lot of commodification that's happening, and even with my students, I have issues with, I don't know how to mark their papers, because I kind of feel, well, half of it is not right. They're getting all the information online. It's like, you know, and there's so much bastardization and commodification that's happening. But I'm just going like, how else will they know? It's like, you know, I mean, I have first-hand experience because I grew up, Peranakan. But I'm just, yeah, so I struggle with this. But what can I do?
The commodification of Chinese Peranakan culture is something that Lillian struggles with too.
And there are some things that I am, in the recent years, beginning not to like. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, the kebaya shops that's renting out kebaya. Mm-hmm. They put Malay hairpins on their hair, you know, like an added bonus for the customers. Right, okay, but yeah. It's like, oh no.
Not traditional.
Yeah. And the men's clothes is... I've never seen a Baba wearing the clothes they imagined and they put on the tourists to wear. Mm. So it's like maybe cannibalizing the culture because the world is going to think, oh, Baba Nonyas wear like this. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And tourists can't tell. The tourists can't tell the difference. Yeah.
Yeah. And especially when it's in here.
Yeah.
They think that it's, you know, it should be Baba Nonya. So, and so many restaurants coming up which some are not so good, yeah. But people still go because they don't know any better, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah. And,
So is that upsides and downsides to tourism?
Mm, mm.
It's brought a lot of people here, but it's also diluted the culture.
Mm-hmm. And then I am for people who are interested to get to know our culture or be enculturated, acculturated or enculturated. But then some people starts to use it for profit, claiming they're Peranakans or having a Peranakan business and claiming to be Baba Nonyas.
With so much misinformation about the culture, so much commodification and cultural appropriation, what's the solution to preserving the culture for the future?
The newer generation also need to sort of like embrace the culture and evolve with it as well. It's like, so maybe blue rice will have to be, you know, part of Peranakan food. I don't know. Because I'm just going like, I have a reference point for what is authentic because of what I have lived through, right? It's like, you know, but culture never remains static. Yeah, so this is also another issue that I'm kind of like going, I tend to be a purist in a lot of things, but I'm also kind of like realizing the younger generation, that may alienate them and it may not be their reality as well. So it's like, you know, how do we kind of like bridge the gap with the younger generation?
Yeah.
The older generation is dying, it's like, and the newer generation just have not seen what the older generation have seen. So I want to pass everything that I know to my niece. It's like, yeah, but I realize that I will still bring a lot to the grave with me.
I think it is the family. Because how much you enculturate the children and pass that on and not go with the flow. So like my daughter, I'm very happy to say that I managed to enculturate her because she dresses up in sarong kebaya from, she was just 14 years old, and she promotes the culture still, and she writes. Other relatives who have got daughters like 40 years old that have never put on a kebaya in 40 years, they are nonyas, they haven't worn a kebaya before. So that is how much the person, how much the parent encourages and how much the child wants to receive. Because families are now moving out, I think like associations are good, clubs or even among families, and to have it like once a year or any celebration, everybody comes back, everybody dresses in kebaya, we eat the food, we play mahjong, we bring home your kasut manik, And we do ronggeng. But of course, I understand it's getting harder.
That was Dr. David Neo, Peranakan researcher, and Lillian Tong, Peranakan community leader. So Phila, I thought that was a really interesting discussion from both people, especially that last segment where we were talking about cultural preservation. Mm. Because in so many of our previous interviews that we've done, culture hasn't been preserved and they're struggling to preserve it. But with Chinese Peranakan culture, it has gone through a revival. It is being preserved in some way, but that hasn't solved the issue. It's just created new issues, especially in regards to commodification and what we now think is Chinese Peranakan culture.
Yeah, that is a shame. I think that it's being bastardized, as David says, and that people are just kind of using it as an excuse to play dress up.
But I guess you can't really blame tourists because they don't know. They're going to the country to try and figure out or trying to learn. But the issue is not the tourists, it's from the businesses that are commodifying incorrectly the culture. And I can see how even a well-meaning person or business can appropriate culture incorrectly very, very easily.
Yeah.
So David gave the example of blue rice. So in Nyonya food, you would only stain glutinous rice, which you'd call pulut. This is a very different word to regular rice called nasi.
Okay.
But a well-meaning food writer, for instance, could translate glutinous rice to just rice. Mm. And then another food writer might read that and think, oh, all rice is blue in Nyonya cuisine. And then that becomes the dominant narrative that's perpetuated over and over again in blogs and into social media. And then that myth of blue rice appears in AI summaries and ChatGPT, and then that becomes the dominant. So I can see very easily how a culture can be twisted and contorted from what it actually was.
Right, and it's coming also from the fact that it is a hybrid culture of two races, and so like those demarcation lines between the two are going to be very blurry.
Yeah.
Even like yourself, you know, your grandmother was Nyonya, but you are then 1/8 Nyonya, and so therefore, what does that mean? Does your food only have 1/8 of the amount of blue dye in it?
Like, Sometimes, you know, in food writing today, it's really unpopular to suggest that there's such a thing as authenticity. It's really unpopular to say that there's no such thing as authenticity and that there are many ways to interpret culture. I think the danger in that is that small aspects of the culture can become amplified and then twist what the majority of the culture know it to actually be.
Right.
Or it risks just appropriating the culture altogether because I always think authenticity is on a spectrum. To say aspects of our culture is authentic depends on who you are, where you're living, and the time and place that you're living.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And well, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, culture is evolving.
Yeah, exactly. So I think when we say that authenticity doesn't exist, we run the risk of erasing very meaningful cultural traditions, whether we realize it or not. I just think that whenever we're talking about any aspect of cultural traditions, we should try and contextualize it more. So rather than saying authenticity doesn't exist, let's talk about the story, the very specific story about whatever tradition you're talking about, whether it's food, whether it's your costume or anything else.
Yeah, but then what happens if you have like people whose parents don't respond to it and so therefore don't cook or dress in such a way, and you have these kind of people who have been orphaned from their own culture, do you know what I mean, having to go and do that kind of research that they don't actually have a personal connection with. That's a difficult thing for people to seize upon and feel authentic within themselves. It's messy, isn't it?
It's messy, but I think that's how cultures evolve. And you know, I was talking before how in my family we make laksa with chicken. I should never say to anyone that this is a quote-unquote authentic Malaysian laksa.
Right.
But I can say that this is authentic to a Malaysian diaspora. Mm. And the reason why we use chicken rather than, say, prawns is because it's cheaper, it's easier to get hold of. And I think it's beautiful to have both stories and both representations.
Yeah, I think it is wrong to kind of deny people their own ancestry just because they're not being orthodox.
Absolutely. So yeah, it is really messy, but I'm really grateful to both David and Lillian for sharing their perspectives to add more depth to this story. So back to our symbol of the day, which is of course laksa. Laksa really is a symbol of Chinese Peranakan culture, which is itself though a product of British colonialism. So when you eat a bowl of laksa, think about the events that led to the emergence of Chinese Peranakan communities. But back to our history, the events of the 18th century effectively suppressed the formation of a new centralized Malay power. So now there was no more Srivijaya type reign. There's no Malaccan type city that's arrived. And that's largely due to the regicide, the assassination of the Sultan of Johor.
Right.
And that allowed players like the British East India Company to come in and take control. And following the acquisition of Penang, they also end up gaining Singapore a few years later. And they did that by essentially propping up a puppet successor to the throne. They just kind of got this guy and was like, yeah, he's the new Sultan. And therefore he controls Singapore. Therefore we will sign a treaty with him. Therefore we have Singapore legally.
Right. Okay.
Dutch VOC was not happy about this because it's encroaching on their territory.
Right.
They are claiming that their treaty is illegal and wrong. So this bout has profound impacts for the region again, which we're going to explore in the next episode, Toddy and the Colonizers' Secret Treaty. So don't miss the next episode of Satay.
Okay.